Welcome. My name is DeAndre. I am your host for a Distinct Lens podcast. And I have a special guest here with us today. Her name is Natasha Greenland. I'll allow her to introduce herself.
My name is Natasha Greenland, and I'm Trey's guest today.
Yes. So, I guess we'll hop right in. A few questions for background.
Okay.
How old are you, and what do you do for a living?
So, I've recently turned 27. Yay! And I am a CI practitioner. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Who knows? So basically it just means that we kind of run continuous improvement initiatives around the business. We do small changes, big changes, manage some projects, coach some projects. People usually struggle to describe what it is.
It sounds interesting and complicated and important.
I wouldn't say complicated. It's quite simple. You know, you see issues or you see things that can be improved or fixed, and you basically go in and help the people in those areas to improve them. So, yeah, I'm quite new to the role. I've not been in it that long. I was previously a people manager. Okay. So, yeah, I'm learning as I go.
Okay, interesting. Mm-hmm. So, where are you from? As you can tell, I'm not from the UK. We're both in the UK right now.
Yeah.
I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. Mm-hmm. Where are you from?
So I am from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, Southern Africa. I've been in the UK now for 8 years. This July was 8 years, actually.
So you were in your teens when you moved over here.
Yes, I was actually 18 when I moved over. So I was 18, just about to turn 19 when I moved over. So pretty young.
Yeah.
I obviously thought I was older, but hindsight, I wasn't.
Okay, so what was life like back in Zimbabwe?
Where do you even start with Zimbabwe? I think it's quite a different place, you know. I'm probably the only person in this room that can say I've been a trillionaire once in my life. Have you?
No, I cannot say that.
Exactly. So Zimbabwe was pretty... it was a really different place. So, you know, in 2007, I think it was, the economy completely crashed. So it's literally been nuts over there. We've obviously had a dictatorship. It was a different, I wouldn't say your average upbringing, but yeah.
So you said the economy crashed in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that what caused the devaluation of the money and what made you a trillionaire, so to speak?
Yes. So I remember seeing things in the news where people would go to buy a loaf of bread with a wheelbarrow of money. Remember going to school and asking for spending money from my mom and her giving me 200 million US Zimbabwean dollars to take for spending money. It could only buy a bag of crisps.
But,
yeah. So I remember that.
Okay, so you said your mom.
Yeah.
What does she do for a living?
So my mom works in the same place as I do, but she is a warehouse operative. So she's kind of jumped about. She's only not that long ago joined the same business as me. That's what she does. It isn't what she's always done. So she used to work in a pharmacy back in Zimbabwe, but usually just kind of, you know, over-the-counter jobs.
Okay. And what about your dad? Was he in the picture?
Yeah, so my
siblings.
Yeah, so my father basically, so he was in and out. He lived in the UK for a bit. He lived back home for a bit. He actually had really, really decent jobs growing up. So sometimes we had loads of money and sometimes we didn't because he jumped from job to job. So. Mm. He had really good jobs growing up, but at the minute he also works as a warehouse operative. I think he just lost the drive. I don't know. But yeah, so he's jumped from job to job.
Okay, so when you were growing up, did you have siblings?
Yeah, two brothers and myself.
Oh, so it was three in the house.
Yeah, there's three of us.
Similar to me, like it was me and my two, well, it was our boys. Me and
my two brothers.
Older brother, younger brother.
Ah, mine are both older than me.
So you're the baby.
Yeah, I'm the baby. Yeah. Okay. Only girl and the baby.
Do they live in the UK? Or
no, no. So they live back home. Yeah.
So you were the brave one to say, hey.
I'm out.
Okay.
Yeah. So how that actually came about was I turned 18, obviously, and I didn't yet have a job. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to, you know, go back to school and stuff. And my father was in the UK and my mum was like, hey, why don't you, you know, go over, see how it is. You don't have to go over for that long, go over for a couple of months or so. So I did. Mm-hmm. And then I stayed.
You came for a couple months.
A couple of months. 8 years later, I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think for me, what kind of kept me was the independence over here. So obviously in Zimbabwe with the economy, you know, very few people my age tend to, you know, move out. So I know loads of people I grew up with who still have to live with their parents or grandparents. There's lots of generations in the same household because things are so expensive and, you know, buying a house in Zimbabwe is unheard of. So I think for me, when I came over here, it was the independence that the UK gave me. You know, I worked, I had my own flat by the age of 19, so it's what kind of kept me.
Yeah, so you had a lot of drive.
Yeah.
So growing up, did your parents talk to you about finances, or did they instill that drive that you have? Or is that something you've always had?
I would say no. So for me, in terms of money in my household, you know, obviously my father jumped from job to job. So usually he had a lot of money. So he got really good jobs, but they tended not to last for too long. So, you know, when things were good, they were really good. I remember him having loads of money. And, you know, I remember, so in Zimbabwe, you have to pay tuition for school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day it was like,
Is for public school? Well, I shouldn't say
for any school. Yeah. So any school in Zimbabwe you have to pay for.
So even when you're young up until you're an adult, you have to pay for school.
Yep.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. So I remember actually it was like a fun day, a school fun day. And I remember going in and the spending money that my father had given me to take for this fun day was double the amount that my school fees were. So I remember, so I remember having a lot of money, but I also remember that when that money wasn't there, you know, they weren't such great times. And I suppose for me, my mum also had the attitude of when things were going good, you know, I remember she always used to say, we'll worry about today, God will sort tomorrow out. Mm. And that was kind of what she lived by.
In the moment.
Yeah. So it was always whatever was good for today and, you know, tomorrow's tomorrow's problem. So, yeah.
Now, as a child, do you think you adapted that same type of attitude?
A little bit, but not completely. So I was a bit more, you know, in Zimbabwe, there was no such thing as savings. Like, first of all, when the economy crashed, you know, what was $1 million today, if you didn't spend that today, by the time tomorrow came, quite literally, that money would have devalued so much. So money would devalue overnight or, you know, on a weekly basis. So you never, ever saved money because literally it would be paper within a week. And it sounds extreme, but that was actually it. So, you know, savings and that kind of thing wasn't my thing. But I've always been quite sensible in terms of, you know, money and what needed to be done. So that's where the conversations used to come up with my mum. So it would always be a case of, hey, you know, she'd say, we'll worry about it tomorrow. But I, at the age of 16, 17, was always worrying about tomorrow, you know, as worrying.
That's really interesting, just thinking about how the money could lose its value overnight, and then that influences your behavior. Because I think I would have probably been doing the same thing. It's like, it's not going to be worth anything, so I'm going to spend it all
today.
Spend
it today, yeah.
So, keeping that in mind, like, what drove that sensibility in you to say, well, we need to be concerned about tomorrow and the day after that? What drove that planning in your head?
If I'm honest, I genuinely haven't thought about it before. You know, I've always been quite open that I've always been kind of the different one in my family. So everyone tends to go one way and I'm always the rebel that tends to go the other way. I think for me, I do always think about the future. And I guess at that age, all I was thinking about is I do want to think further than tomorrow, right? I do want to make plans for the future. I suppose I was quite young as well. So for me, you know, I had a lot more life left. So I was still trying to plan for the rest of that. Whereas, you know, sometimes I felt like my mom was just like, hey, we're living a good life. Let's do what we need to do today and we'll worry about tomorrow when it comes. But I don't know, I guess, you know, and this isn't anything to my mom. My mom's a great mom. But my mom isn't the most independent person. She's got a lot better now, but she's never really been. So it used to be my dad that she would kind of rely on a lot.
Financially.
So yeah, financially, completely. And also just, you know, emotionally, even just going to the shops or, you know, going to town, things like that, she'd rely on him.
Total dependency.
Total. So I remember actually, so my uncle used to have to get a bus to town to pick my mom up from work, to get back on the bus to bring her home because she would not get on the bus herself. And I think for me, that was my drive because I remember thinking to myself, no way will someone get onto a bus to come and pick me up from work. So from a really young age, I used to get buses on my own. I used to go into town. I actually remember my father used to send me money when he lived in the UK. So he'd send me money every month, just, you know, spending money. And I would budget it out. So I would be like, okay, so this much I'm going to spend on, you know, what I would like. And this much I'm going to keep for spending money for school or whatever that looked like. So once a month, I'd get a bus into town, take my money and go and spend it on what I wanted to spend it on. So I think the fact that my mum relied on so many people so much and I seen the ugly side of that, I think I always was just determined that I would not rely on anyone that way.
And put yourself in that position.
In that position, yeah. Because, you know, it's not a great thing to be that reliant on people. You know, you can't really do anything for yourself or you're always waiting on someone else to do something for you. And
now something that's interesting that you've mentioned to me before in previous conversations is that you had a kind of entrepreneurial spirit at a young age. So could you tell me a bit about what you were doing in Zimbabwe in order to make money?
So it started, I remember one day, me and my cousin, we were sitting at home. And I had a really nice purse. And I don't know where I got it from, but it was a nice purse. And I remember I was like, oh, I'm so sick of being broke. Like, we were quite young. So I was 18 at the time. I think I just turned 18 or 17, 18. And I was like, you know what? I'm sick to death. Like, I want money. And we need to make money. Obviously, Zimbabwe, if you look it up, there are no jobs. And even if you did get a job, you'd literally be paid about $100 a month.
Wow.
And that would be a good job. So, you know, it wasn't great. So what I'd done was I started to make, I don't know, do you call them? I'll say savory snacks. So they're like pastries and cakes and stuff. Okay. So I used to do a lot of baking. It started off small. So I just used to like do for a few people I knew, a few people in the area. But yeah, it started to get a bit bigger. We had, I won't say contracts because we didn't sign anything. Zimbabwe's not that fancy. But we would have like agreements with certain like takeaway places. So we'd do cakes for them, samosas, weddings.
Okay. So takeaway, just for our American listeners, that is the equivalent of dining out or a restaurant that we would go to and we would pick up food and we would leave from. Because I remember when I first moved to the UK and people would say takeaway. And I was like,
what's that?
Like, what is that? Yeah. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So then you started to have agreements with businesses in the area.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously it's, you know, it's not as so, for example, in the UK, you probably wouldn't be able to do that because you'd need to have, you know, food certificates and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, it was Zimbabwe, they don't really care. So we would do that kind of stuff. So yeah, it moved quite quickly. I remember we used to cater for quite a few weddings and stuff. I actually remember doing something. So when I turned 18, we had a birthday party, and I specifically remember doing 800 samosas that night.
And describe what a samosa is.
So it's like a triangle shaped pastry. Uh-huh. And inside is like spicy minced meat.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, remember making 800 of them,
and I'm assuming people love those.
They do, yeah. It's very, very common in Zimbabwe to have those. Very common.
So did you make a lot of money?
No, it was for my birthday, so I made them for myself.
No, yeah. I mean in your
business.
Oh, in
general, yeah, I did. So in fact, I actually used to end up giving my mom money from it. But yeah, I used to make some good money. Okay. But obviously, it was very time consuming because you literally everything was done yourself. But yeah, it wasn't bad. It got me by.
Okay, so in that backdrop, you're going to school, you growing up with your mom, your dad, he's there, and he's sending you money from the UK.
Yeah.
What was school like? I know you said you had to pay tuition all throughout school. Do you think they prepared you to handle finances, handle money?
Definitely not. We do have, so there was nothing that was ever, you know, taught to us about it. And I guess in all due respect, there was no need to mention anything about it because, like I said, money would devalue so quickly, you know. What were they going to really teach us in school? Because, you know, the economy didn't allow for us to make any, you know, strategic moves or think about what we were doing with our money. So no, we didn't learn about it. I do remember that we used to have an accounts class, but that was as close to money or talking about money that you'd get to.
And that was just one course throughout the years that you went to school.
Yeah, and unlucky for me, so in Zimbabwe, you've got 4 years of high school. So form one, two, three, and four. The town that I lived in, the city that I lived in, only Bulawayo.
Bulawayo.
Yeah. So they only used to start teaching you accounts in form three. That was when you started to learn about it.
And form three, that was the third year?
The third year. Okay. Yeah. So you'd only start learning about it then if you wanted to. So it was a choice. And then I moved to the capital city, Harare, and obviously in that school it was quite different. So they started learning accounts from form one. So I got in there like a few months or about half a year into the school year, and obviously didn't learn any of the basics. And then obviously everyone in my class was ahead of me. So I just didn't learn anything because no one really took the time to go back and say, hey, we understand you've not been here for the first 6 months. Let's go through what we've taught these guys. There wasn't anything like that. So I just fell behind. Even my only opportunity at actually learning anything, and I got there too late.
So did you end up catching up or?
No, my family, we moved back to the original city that I lived in, back to Bulawayo. So I was only there for about 3 months and then we moved back. So.
Okay.
And then by the time it was time to start the other one, it was too late.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning. So you were 18 when you moved to the UK.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming your life was really different than it was in Zimbabwe when you moved to the UK. Like you said, when you turned 19, you got your own flat.
Yeah.
And flats, I think the equivalent of that would be an apartment.
Yeah.
In the United States. So you got your first apartment when you were 19.
Yeah.
You know, there's some people over the world that are getting apartments. I didn't have my own apartment when I was 19. So how did you pull that off?
I had no choice, first of all. So, you know, it was really different for me. So again, I mentioned earlier, my father's not the most reliable person. So when I moved over, he was kind of jumping about, and he actually got kicked out of our first flat that I moved into over here. And then obviously I was living with my cousin for a bit, but things didn't work out. So I literally had to find somewhere to live. So it was either I was going to live in a house, in a shared house. So I don't know, what do you have those in America?
Where people share a common space,
yeah,
in the house?
Yeah. So like this house, for example, so I'd have one room, you'd have one room.
Yeah, it's definitely people that do that, mm-hmm, in the States, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I could have done that, but I think for me, I was planning on getting my mum over to the UK because she was still back in Zimbabwe, so it wouldn't be practical for me to get a room, and then a few months later when my mum comes over, then start looking for a new place. So I just thought, let me get the flat straight away and, mm-hmm, and get her over. It was not a great flat, so if you're picturing some fancy American apartment with exposed brick wall, it was not. But yeah, it was my first home. I remember I moved in with an airbed mattress, mm-hmm, my clothes and a candle. That was it. A nice smelling candle. And that was all I moved into that flat with. But I was happy. It was my space.
You know what? My very first apartment, mm-hmm, similar experience. I had an air mattress.
Yep.
I had my clothes, mm-hmm, my shoes, and I think a lamp. But yep. I had some matches with a candle as well. Yeah. I'll never forget that. I think the, mm-hmm, lights weren't even on. But I was happy because it's my
yours.
Space.
It's yours. Yeah, exactly. And I think at that moment, I kind of knew, well, this is my home. I think that was a big thing for me. So, you know, in Zimbabwe, family is everything. You know, you spend a lot of time with your family. You've always got people around you, you know. And our house in Zimbabwe was always the home that everyone came to. So everyone came to us for food, you know, lunch and the chill. And that was kind of what we had. So when I moved here, obviously quite young, on my own, I got some family, but it wasn't like back home. So I think for me, it was so important getting my own home and just being able to say, this is mine. This is, you know, when you're able to just get home from work, get into your house, close the door, and everything's okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that was important for me when I got my flat.
Okay. Now, how did you... But I know you said this was drove out of necessity, the fact that you got your first, mm-hmm, flat on your own. Did you save your money, or what, did you have a plan?
No plan. So it was actually, I'll go into a bit more detail. So me and my cousin, we ended up falling out. So we ended up
as
not really.
As families do from time to time.
Yeah, yeah. So we fell out, and basically what happened was she got home one day and she was like, right, you need to be out by the end of today. So that was it. So I literally had to move out on the spot. So I ended up moving in with a friend for a month. Mm-hmm. And in that month, I saved up as much as I could to get the flat. So it was literally like, it was, when I tell you last minute, it was a last minute thing. I've saved as much money as I could of, you know, that month. And bear in mind, I had a part-time job and then another part. So I had two part-time jobs. So it wasn't great money. I think I'm still actually on the agency. I don't know. What's agency in UK? In America.
Like a temp agency.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I was still, you know, so the money wasn't great. The work wasn't, obviously if you're on the agency, isn't always reliable. So sometimes there may not be any work for you. So it was risky getting my own place, because essentially if they told us they didn't need us, I had rent to pay. But yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, having that experience in Zimbabwe and, mm-hmm, your initial experience in the UK,
yeah,
I want to ask, do you feel that financial intelligence is important, equally as important in both communities? I know you mentioned before, earlier, from the perspective of money and handling money and managing it,
mm-hmm,
it wasn't so important in Zimbabwe,
yeah,
because of the inflation, mm-hmm, because of the state of the economy,
yeah,
versus when you came to the UK and out of necessity, you had to get things together so that you could get your own place.
Yeah.
Do you think like that awareness about finances, about money, could have benefited you in Zimbabwe equally as it has in the UK?
I would say no. So I think money, the approach to money is very different in Zimbabwe and the UK. And I think the fact that the approach is so different impacted me, you know, in the UK, because moving over here, when it came to money, I don't think I was as clued up as I could have been. You know, I'm 27 now. I definitely could have saved a lot more. I could have been a lot more structured about what I'd done with my money. You know, I remember my first job that I actually got a decent wage in. I spent every single penny of my salary for a year. No, I didn't put £1 away as savings. And I think, and not to blame anything, but I think it was the fact that, you know, because you didn't have that much money in Zimbabwe, when you did get it, you were like, whoa, okay, I've got money. Let me do this. So I think there's two very different approaches. Zimbabwe, you have to be very clued up on how you're going to make money, because, you know, you need, in Zimbabwe, so your rent, for example, will be $300 US. But you earn $150 US. So, you know, it always, how much you earn is always much less than how much you're going to spend. So, you know, in Zimbabwe, it's not as easy as saying I'll be in a full-time job and this will be enough for me. Mm. You're always thinking, right, I've got a job, what else? So I think the approach is quite different. I think it really has impacted me because, like I said, you know, when I moved to the UK, I could have made a lot better decisions when it came to money. And, you know, now I'm 27. I would have had a lot more savings now if I was wiser, if I was a bit more clued up to begin with.
Okay. So even being more clued up, as you say, like if you would have had that awareness even prior to you coming to the UK, do you think that would have been beneficial? Even if it, I guess it wouldn't have applied in that environment.
I don't think it would have applied in that environment because, you know, my mom didn't even have a bank account in Zimbabwe because you'd never put your money in a bank because half of the time you can't get your money out. It's completely different world to everywhere else. So I don't think anything that, I think they could have taught us a bit better in terms of, you know, how you can make money, what are good investments, that kind of stuff. But apart from that, no, it doesn't apply, which makes it even more difficult for me over here, because the first time I really started to learn about it, I was already, you know, a full-grown adult who had already made bad decisions. It's a bit late.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm seeing a lot of parallels in your life story to what I've seen growing up in the United States. I remember my dad used to say, what did he say? He said, well, you act like that money burning a hole in your pocket.
Exactly.
And what he meant by that is that as soon as you get money, you want to spend it.
You want to spend it.
It was like there wasn't a thought about tomorrow. There wasn't a thought about saving. Mm-hmm. Even in my house, like, we didn't talk about finances. Yeah. We didn't talk about saving. We didn't talk about money, period. It was like a taboo subject. Yeah. Like, we didn't talk about money. And then when we did have a little bit, it would be spent. Yeah. Like in my house, like, we live paycheck to paycheck. So if something tragic or drastic was to happen, and sometimes it did, we would have to go without.
Yeah.
And I didn't become financially literate myself until maybe about 7-8 years ago.
Wow.
And yeah, it literally changed my life though. Like when I actually learned how to make money work for me instead of me working for money. Yeah, it changed my whole outlook. And I remember, like, I went back years ago and I had a conversation with my dad about it. And he just opened up to me about how little he knew about money.
Really?
And how little he knew about interest rates and how to buy a home and all these things that are important to, you know, having stability in a family. Like, those things are super important to know. So it's just interesting hearing your story and how it parallels some of the things that happened in my life and some of the things that I've seen happen in other black people's lives in America.
Because like you say, you know, two completely opposite ends of the world, and yet stories can be so similar.
So obviously, A Distinct Lens is, well, I don't want to say obviously, but A Distinct Lens is a platform for the black diaspora to share their experiences so that we may level up in terms of financial intelligence and maybe just connect a bit more. to understand what life is like for other people in different places. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask, keeping that in mind, just thinking about recent events in the news, I know here they call it the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. In the United States, yeah, that's a part of it, mm-hmm. but it's a continuum, and this okay. is just the modern day manifestation of injustices mm-hmm. that have been going on in America for hundreds yes. of years. So I wanted to ask you, like, in terms of the protests, that are you, well, they've been protesting even in the UK. Like, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so funny enough, they actually protest in Corby, believe it or not. It's, you know, it's a small town, it's predominantly white. So yeah,
I did not know that. So for all our listeners, we are mm-hmm. currently in Corby, a small town about an hour train's ride north of London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there were protests, there were quite a few. Even in neighboring small towns, there were protests as well.
Wow.
And funny enough, the people that actually went to protest were predominantly white. I think Corby had two black people that went to it.
Really?
Yeah. And that was quite, I won't say I liked it, but it kind of made me feel better about the whole situation, because sometimes, you know, you feel like it's us against them in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that so many white people turned up and were so upset about the way that things were, you know, transpiring, I think that was a bit, it gave me a bit of hope that, hey, you know, there are people, regardless of skin color, there's people out there who are really angry about what's going on and outraged enough. You know, it was an American thing, it happened in America, mm-hmm. but it hit home with so many people around the world. And yeah, even little Corby was involved in that.
Now, you said it happened in America, and mm-hmm. Now the protests have spread to the rest yeah. of the world. Do you think there's racism in England?
So had you asked me this 6 months ago, I'd have said, yeah, probably. But, you know, I don't see it. I don't hear of it. So, you know, I've been quite, and I think, you know, we've been speaking for a while, and I've always been quite open that because I don't really care what color people are, I tend to walk around with blinkers on and just think everyone thinks the way that I think. Mm-hmm. But I think racism in the UK is very subtle. So I think people don't, you know, America's quite out there, you know, people will go up to you in the street and, you know, point out your race or anything like that. I've lived in the UK for 8 years. I've never ever had anyone in a negative way, mm-hmm. you know, say anything about my race. I've had people compliment me and say, you know, really pretty, or they love my skin tone or whatever that is, but it's never ever been, you know, a negative experience. However, and I think that was where I was quite naive, in the sense that I thought, well, you know, everyone's so nice about it, like, no one, it's not an issue. Mm-hmm. And I think when the protest started and I started to see lots and lots and lots of comments people were making on social media, mm-hmm. I think that was when I started to think, huh, okay, this is different. I didn't think there was this much of it going on.
Now the comments, let's talk a bit about that. So what do you mean?
Do you know, it wasn't even the comments about people of color. It was the ignorance to the fact that racism exists that really got me. So, you know, for me, it was the fact that people couldn't understand, just because it doesn't impact them directly, or it wasn't directed right at them. It was as if they couldn't understand that it was an issue. And, you know, not addressing an issue is enabling an issue. And sitting well back said. And pretending that something isn't there, or even if you strongly believe something's not there, or you believe it doesn't exist, you know, you still have that little bit of something in your head that says, well, hey, wait a minute. There's all these people of color who are all saying this is how they've been treated. Surely there's you know, my mom used to say, there's no smoke without a fire, right?
Right.
So, you know, surely there's some truth to it. But it was just like people were just oblivious. And they were actually telling people just to pipe down, just to chill out. Like, what are you freaking out for? You know, all this racism business, there's no such thing. And that those were the comments that actually got me. Not the people who were being racist, the ones who were refusing to acknowledge that there was an issue.
How did that make you feel?
Rubbish. You know, I've always loved who I am. I've always loved the color of my skin. You know, I've never ever looked in the mirror one day and thought to myself, oh, I wish I was white, or I wish I was this, or anything like that. I've never felt rubbish for the color of my skin. So for it to hit me at the age of 27, mm-hmm. that it was almost as if I'd lived this lie for 27 years, and now all of a sudden it was like, wow, like all these people out there, you know, the way they behave, in the things that they do into people, it was just the pure hatred for someone else that you don't even know that really, really got me. And I think for me, whenever it comes to difficult subjects, so I hate animal cruelty and all of that kind of stuff. So whenever there's those difficult topics or subjects, my brain refuses to process that information. So I found it really hard in the beginning to process the information. So I blocked it out, didn't want to read anything on, you know, social media or the news or anything. I'd turn it off. But, you know, again, I was being a bit of a hypocrite, because by ignoring it, you're not acknowledging the problem that's there. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't great. Like I said, you know, I've been a bit naive for 27 years. So to just wake up one day and be like, wow, this is real, this is a big thing, it was difficult.
Okay, so now that you had that, mm-hmm. that moment of awakening, what is your view on it now?
I'm hopeful. So I genuinely am hopeful. I think, you know, a lot of the younger generations are against it. You know, a lot of the younger generations are quite conscious and aware, and even aware of passive aggressive racism. So mm-hmm. not the out in broad daylight racism. People are aware of the small things people might say, or the small ways people might behave. So I'm hopeful that, you know, probably generation after me, or whatever that looks like, will not have to go through the same things that my generation or older generations have had to go through. Mm. In the beginning, I wasn't hopeful. I felt quite hopeless. I was just like, you know, what's the point? Like, you know, I couldn't control what was going on in the world. I couldn't control the way people were behaving to other people. Mm. I couldn't comprehend how someone could automatically dislike someone based, not even knowing the first thing about that person, but just solely based on the color of their skin. You know, so I did feel a bit rubbish for the first few weeks that everything was kicking off. But then, you know, there were a lot of positive comments as well. There were a lot of people who, you know, acknowledged it. Especially in the UK, it's big. It's so, I think generations after me are so diverse. Mm. You know, people, you literally see people walking around. There's Eastern European people, there's black people, there's white people, there's British people. Everyone's mixed, and nobody actually cares what color or nationality or what language other people speak. It's just they take you for who you are. So I'm hopeful. Whether or not we'll see it in my generation, I don't know, but I am hopeful for the generations after me.
Okay. So, I'm just curious now, now that you are more aware mm-hmm. of what's going on in the world, do you think you've ever experienced racism in your professional life?
I don't think I have, but again, this is UK, it can be very subtle, so you know, it may have been there, I just may have been quite naive to it. Mm. I haven't actually really reflected on, you know, previous experiences in my professional, whether or not I believe they were racist or anything like that. I haven't actually reflected on it, but from first glance, I don't think so. I'd hope not. I think I'd be quite disappointed to think that anyone was to treat me any differently, or, you know, not give me opportunities or give me opportunities, because, you know, it goes both ways. Right. Someone giving you a job because you're black to kind of even things out is not great either. But I don't think I have, and I hope I haven't, because I'd be really disappointed.
Now, I want to tie all this together. Mm-hmm. And this will be my last question before we close. Mm-hmm. With what you were saying about how you grew up in Zimbabwe and your experiences in the UK, mm-hmm. and how the approach to money was so different in both societies.
Yeah.
And it from my experience, like the community I come from, it's majority black. Mm-hmm. And I've been to quite a few places here in the UK, and the nicer neighborhoods, they usually reflect, well, even just the communities, they reflect that of America. Mm-hmm. So the nicer places you go to, the less black people. You see. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say it's by accident, because I understand how systems work. Mm-hmm. You know, it was set up this way, and not mm-hmm. necessarily for black people to be at the bottom, but yeah. there's just a lack of information. And so mm-hmm. when you were talking about how it wasn't presented to you in yeah. Zimbabwe, and that information wasn't given to you mm-hmm. about finances, and you, from your own perspective, you're like, well, it wasn't relevant. Mm-hmm. But just, I'm just thinking in my head, I'm like, well, what if not only you,
yeah.
but your family mm-hmm. and other families within the community that you lived in,
yeah.
what if everybody had a really good financial understanding of how money worked,
yeah.
and how to pool their resources, mm-hmm. and how to work together? Do you think that would have made a difference?
Definitely. You know, you touched on the fact that there's communities over here that, you know, they tend not to have a lot of black people in them, so the richer communities don't have a lot of black people. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a big part of that, is because those communities, those really fancy, lots of money communities, that's not because John woke up one day and became a millionaire. That's because it's generation after generation passing down asset to asset to asset. Mm-hmm. So, you know, black people have only really started to come up in communities and society in the past, 100 years maybe?
If that.
So, you know, it was, I think that's why they've got a lot of catching up to do. They've got years and years and years of catching up to do before they can even be in that position, if they can ever be in that position. So I think that plays a big part as to why there's not a lot of black people in those communities. Another thing you touched on was, you know, if people were maybe a bit more educated when it came to money, back home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about it, take Zimbabwe for an example. When people talk about Zimbabwe, it was known as the breadbasket of Africa at one point, because literally people made everything. There was manufacturing companies in Zimbabwe, you know. It was probably at one point rivaled South Africa, for example, because, you know, we were up there when it came to African countries. But we were obviously run by the British, because we're still a colony. And then obviously the British lost and they had to leave, and, you know, black Zimbabweans took over. Mm-hmm. But you've got to remember, the people that took over were people that were not allowed to go to school, or could only go to school until a certain level. They were not allowed to go to university. Mm-hmm. So our president actually had to leave Zimbabwe to go to another country to go to university, because legally in Zimbabwe, he wouldn't have been allowed to go to university.
Wow.
And what you then found is you got a very small group of leaders in Zimbabwe who were educated, and a lot of black people under them who were not educated.
Wow.
So these ones that were educated tend to pull all the strings and make sure that things suited them. And that is essentially why we've got to the point we've got to. You know, I think that played a massive part in it. The fact that, you know, basically we were just left. They were like, right, here's your leaders, here's your people, take your land back. And it was, yeah, it was just dumped on people who had not even gone to university. So I think that played a big part in the downfall of Zimbabwe. And again, that goes all the way back down. My grandfather always worked, you know, the lower end jobs, because again, if you were black, you didn't get the better jobs. You didn't tend to own any land or anything like that. So I think that just went generation after generation. And another thing that I've found people in my family as well do is, you know, if they've got a profession, for example, they, you know, weld or whatever that is, they tend to get their kids to do the same job as them because it works. It worked for them. It was, you know, it paid the bills. It got them to where they got to. So they pass that mentality on generation after generation. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I think sometimes they do put pressure on the younger generations to follow the same footsteps as them. So any bad habits that they may have picked up or, you know, anything like that, they then just pass it on generation to generation. So had we had our parents who were a bit more, you know, money literate, it would have passed down to us, and essentially we would have been more educated when it came to the decisions we made. But all we had was generation after generation making bad decisions, or not the greatest decisions.
I think you summed it up really well. Generational wealth is built through the understanding of how money works. And when you don't have that understanding, when you don't have that education, and like in the example you gave, a country is handed over to you. What do you think is going to happen? It's just like when you give $1 million to someone who doesn't have a middle school education. Like, what do you think they're going to do with that
money? Exactly. And that's essentially what happened. And, you know, people talk about it in Zimbabwe, and you know, some people in the black community as well say, you know, Zimbabwe was better when, you know, we had white people running it. But actually, no, it wasn't due to the color of their skin. It was due to the fact, like you say, they were literate. They knew what they were doing. They, you know, they learned it from their families, because the people that went over to Zimbabwe weren't uneducated. They were very educated people. That's why they were sent over when they were colonizing, because, you know, you're going to send your key people in, aren't you? Your most intelligent, your people who are able to build roads and cities and all of that kind of stuff. So those are the people they sent in. So of course they knew how to handle money and what to do with it. So, you know, saying that it was better when it was run by white people is a bit unfair, you know, considering when you've handed it to black people, you've given, you know, they barely went to school. And even if they did, it was, you know, they never ever reached senior school, for example. So what did you expect to happen? And then if you've got those people running a whole country, who's going to teach anyone anything?
Well said. Usually I do a wrap up, but I don't think I need to in this case.
Talk too much.
No. It was perfect. Thank you for being on the show.
No, thank you for having me.
And I hope everyone enjoyed listening as much as I did.
Thank you.
Thank you.